We made this.
X-Cast, the truth is in here. Thanks for joining our X-Cast patron roundtable discussion of Mulder's interactions with the other men characters that have appeared on the X-Files. I'm your host, Marlene Stimmy, and I'm delighted to be joined today by patrons Chandru Ravindran and Luke Winch. Hey guys, how's it going?
Hi,
good. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing well.
Good, I'm well.
So yeah, welcome back. I think that you all appeared together in our teasers and cold opens roundtable, which was... It was either earlier this year or late last year. I can't at this point remember.
It was pre-pandemic.
Our pre-pandemic roundtable on teasers and cold opens was the last time that we have all talked.
Yeah, it was another world and another time.
Yes.
Right. Exactly. So this time we're going to be discussing Mulder's relationships with the other male characters on the X-Files. And our most recent roundtable that we recorded earlier this month was about Scully's relationships with other women characters. So I think this will be kind of an interesting thing to see if we have some of the same themes and relationship dynamics with Mulder that the patrons on that roundtable had for Scully, or just how they differ and how they're similar. So what we've decided to do is start with Mulder's relationship with his father, Bill Mulder, and then kind of go through some of the nature of the familial relationships, paternal relationships, and some of the other categories that we see as kind of related to Mulder's relationships with the men on the show, and then themes that come out from that. So we also have a few listener responses that we're going to go through toward the end. All right, well, I believe that Luke is going to get started for us here.
Yeah, so William Mulder is quite an interesting one, because I think it's not so much the relationship and interaction with William Mulder and Mulder, it's actually the lack of. And I think this estrangement and this kind of disassociation that Mulder and his father have is the driving force between his other relationships that he makes throughout the series. And I think the lack of a father in his life is quite indicative of how he treats his mentors and other associates throughout the show. And I think one of the most important lines in season one is, I even made my parents call me Mulder, which I still find one of the most weirdest things ever. It's like, hi, Mum, hi, Dad, I don't want you to call me by my birth name. Just call me by the family surname. It's just like so bizarre.
But gotta wonder if his parents listen to him.
But it's a real...
They don't seem to have. Yeah. We'll see him later.
But it's a really good line, because it shows how estranged he is from his mother, and particularly his father. And particularly William's objection to Mulder's quest to find Samantha and to chase the X-Files, and I think that objection is the catalyst behind their contentious relationship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what you said about him, his like sort of an absence of a relationship with him, that's exactly why I wanted you to start with it, because I was thinking about his relationship with William Mulder, I was thinking of it along the lines of how are all his relationships with all of the authoritative male figures in his life, and I was like, it's really different because it's so minimalized in the show, both in the show and by the fact that he is estranged with him. Like, we only see him with his father twice, I think. And he's very... It seems like there's a lot of history. Obviously there's a lot of history. It's father and son, but it's a lot of it's already happened before by the time we get there. And so it's when we meet him in Colony, they're already very distant. You could see, Mulder goes in for the hug. He only gets a handshake, and then the roles are reversed in Anasazi. But it's like... Mulder seems constantly sort of mopey around him, like just despondent and down. And I mean, part of it's just because of the stresses of the mythology episodes it's in, but you just get a sense that Mulder is like, that estrangement, that distance has like either detached him or exhausted him from his relationship with his dad. And like you said, Luke, it's fed into sort of how he acts out towards his other mentors when they don't fall in line with what Mulder expects of them.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting that he's, you said he's mopey around them. I think that's that's a great description. And it seems to me that in those, the two times that we see Bill, well, really like any time we've seen Bill Mulder, because there's the scene also with the cigarette smoking man earlier in Anasazi and a few things like that, but he always seems like his mind is somewhere else. And I think that's true, especially in the scenes with Mulder. He's always thinking about something else, like thinking about the past or thinking about what
he could have
has
done.
Happened before, or what he could have done. Like, yeah, there's this like sense of regret that he kind of puts on Mulder, which is kind of an interesting way to see Mulder going forward from that.
Yeah. And I do wish that I love Anasazi, one of my favorite episodes. I wonder what it would have been like had Mulder found out about his dad's involvement in the conspiracy before his death. Because he never has, like, in the show, we never see, you know, an emotional... Mulder's always having, like, these outbursts with male authority figures, but we never see it with his dad. And I wonder if it would have sort of played out in the same way as it does when he, you know, when he gets mad at Skinner or at someone else. I wonder, or would it be more... Would Mulder fall into more of, like, a subservient son role with his dad? Like, that's one thing I don't know if Mulder, I guess, adjusting for the fact that he feels so powerless with his dad, then he just goes all out against other father figures. But we'll never know, because Krycek went ahead and killed him.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said subservient, because I think in a way, when he has to approach William and tell him that he lost Samantha, and he's very subservient in that scene, and he's actually scared of his father's reaction in that moment.
Yeah.
And it's a real moment of vulnerability that Mulder has at that point.
Yeah, I think he's very vulnerable. And I think that, I wouldn't say necessarily the opposite of that, but I think like a big surprise for Mulder is in Anasazi, when his father is almost switched from this sort of, you know, controlling and judging mode into admiration, when he's telling him that he's kind of, you know, Mulder has taken his own path and his politics have always been his own and so forth. And it's just at that last minute of his life, he's saying these things that Mulder probably wouldn't have expected to hear, and that his father actually thought something different of him than he'd ever expected.
Yeah, and it's like what Mulder wanted to hear all his life and just never got until that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
What you were talking about his vulnerability in front of his father and how he's displaying that with the other, you know, figures that have some sort of, either he almost turns authority figures into paternal figures in some cases, although I don't know if that's our expectation or his or both, you know, how that goes. But I think there's an aspect of either being vulnerable or not wanting to be vulnerable that he's carrying into some of these other relationships.
I think he wants to be vulnerable with them, but he has such, I think based on his, because I think, you know, in the pilot, Mulder mentions that Samantha's disappearance tore the family apart, which implies that lots and lots of fights with both parents. And obviously he's detached from his dad. I feel like he has this vulnerability with other male authority figures and mentors, but he has really high expectations of them. For example, Skinner, you know, Skinner starts off as an antagonist to Mulder, and Mulder's not super friendly to him until the beginning of season two, when Skinner starts to show outwardly that he's sort of on his side. But anytime Skinner doesn't just like go all the way to the truth is out there, we need to do this, Mulder seems like almost crestfallen that Skinner's not 100% behind him. And it causes, I always feel like his vulnerability comes out in the way he acts out with Skinner. He'll just like barge into his office nonstop whenever he feels slighted in the least. Oh, you sent me to Newark to investigate like a sewage murder or whatever? Let me just barge in without checking if you have a meeting. He does this like grandstanding and stuff. He's like screaming out, I expect more from you. Why can't you be exactly the way I wish my dad would have been, or something like that? That's what I get when I think about this a little bit deeper.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I mean, especially regarding Skinner, I think the turning point in that relationship is the scene in One Breath, where he is refusing Mulder's resignation. And you could almost put that conversation that they have as a kind of father and son heart to heart, where, you know, Skinner's pouring his heart out and telling the truth about this experience that he refuses to face, and he says to Mulder, you know, you can face that fear and I can't. And I think that kind of dynamic between them in that particular scene is maybe something that Mulder has wanted from Skinner for a while, that kind of recognition.
Yeah, it's interesting you said that that's the turning point is in One Breath, because, you know, when rewatching the show, we get to the scene in Ascension when Skinner says, you know, I'm reopening the X-Files. And it's like a huge hero moment for Skinner, for the fans. But Mulder's reaction is he looks at him and then turns and like storms out. And I'm always a little, not caught off guard, but just Mulder's not, well, obviously Scully's been abducted, so he's not in the best mood. But he doesn't take it like, oh, Skinner's on my side. He just takes it like, it's almost like he doesn't trust that what Skinner's doing is like actually, that Skinner's wholeheartedly into it. But you're right, in one breath, when Skinner opens up and gives him back some of that vulnerability, that's when Mulder's like, this is a true ally for me. And that's why Skinner's straddling the line throughout the show, I think, continuously hurts Mulder.
I think it's interesting what you're talking about with just Mulder acting out, you know, because that's like something that a sort of a surly teenager would do, like to appear like, why aren't you perfect, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So maybe he's putting that expectation on him. I tend to think that the sort of like the father aspect of that relationship with Mulder is negative, but then I forget, going back to One Breath, that was overwhelmingly positive, because I think Skinner's supposed to be his boss. Mm. He's not supposed to be the father figure. He's not supposed to have that kind of role, but it makes a lot of sense that Mulder would like put that, you know, onto him, kind of like looking for those same patterns maybe, or a different pattern than he had with his father.
I think it is kind of negative, but it's what you said, how he's like a surly teenager. It's because Skinner basically has to parent him, because Skinner cares deeply about both Mulder and Scully's quest as the show progresses, but like Mulder does not make it easy on him. He's constantly questioning authority and circumventing like rules and regulations and putting Skinner in a bind. So it ends up with Skinner chewing him out a lot. So it comes off negative, but I feel like it's Skinner's just basically holding on by the skin of his teeth as Mulder's, you know, pulling on his leash basically throughout the entire show.
Yeah. I think it's interesting too, at least to me, I've never seen Skinner as entirely noble in his motivation. I think there are moments when he really is, but I think that his main motivation in the show is protecting himself.
That's true.
I think he gets out of that sometimes, and he always is like, well, this next time I'm going to have integrity. This next time I'm going to do the right thing or whatever, you know? And I think there are moments when he tries, but I don't think that he really gets to that place. Even through Kitten, it's like, well, this time it's not going to be that way. And I just think that's part of his...
That's who he is.
Like a character flaw in his character and who he is. Exactly. But that makes it interesting then that like in all of these sort of, you know, if you will, father figures that Mulder finds, that sort of self-preservation is their primary motive.
Yeah.
Including his own father.
Yeah, and Deep Throat. Mm-hmm. And it's again, it's like Mulder's expectation is that, you know, it's a character flaw that Skinner and Deep Throat are, you know, protecting themselves also. But Mulder views that as a serious flaw, like this is unforgivable, because he expects everyone to sacrifice themselves for the truth, which, you know, in real life, that's kind of hard to expect someone of that, something of, or that of someone. When Skinner doesn't, you know, when Skinner does, you know, disappoints him, or when Deep Throat reveals that Mulder is not the center of his universe, and Deep Throat ends up using him a couple times, so it's, you know, it's a contentious relationship in those moments, but it's still Mulder, when he realizes, you know, their quest isn't as noble as what I perceived it to be, it frustrates him to no end, I think.
There's an interesting an interesting parallel between Skinner's admission in One Breath of what happened to him and Deep Throat's admission to executing an alien in EBE. They're quite similar scenes in that context, where these two men are kind of bonding in this way. And I think Deep Throat's an interesting paternal figure, because like you said, he is protecting himself, but I also think he's protecting Mulder to a certain degree. And also, if Mulder's getting a little bit too good and a little bit too close, he's not afraid to kind of divert him away. And I think in EBE especially is a really good example of that relationship between those two.
Yeah, Mulder sometimes just sort of forgets what these characters are doing for him and what they've done for him. Like, you know, Deep Throat puts himself, his life in danger every time he approaches Mulder. And yes, it is messed up that Deep Throat ends up lying to him in EBE, but it's like, I feel like had Deep Throat lived past the season finale, I wonder again, like, would their relationship have been more contentious at that point? Because it's towards the end of season one when Scully basically makes Mulder really look at him or look at Deep Throat and what he's, you know, what his motivations are. And it's, I think sometimes Mulder fails to acknowledge what these characters do for him. You know, Skinner puts himself on the line repeatedly through 8 seasons, and then, you know, bad writing in season 10 and 11 aside, you know, when he when he becomes a, you know, sort of a CSM, not really a CSM lackey, but he's I don't know, having clandestine meetings with CSM in season 11, and then Mulder launches into, I mean, Mulder and Scully both stop trusting him. I mean, I think it's bad writing, but from a character standpoint, it fits that Mulder seems to have tunnel vision. Like, it's what have you done for me now? Like, or sometimes he thinks beyond that. It's like, oh, you've done so much for me, but Mulder's an emotional creature by his nature, and he gets riled up by those emotions in the moment very easily, which causes him to, I think, cloud his judgment of where these people stand with him, which works positively sometimes, and then negatively in terms of he immediately trusts strangers whenever they come up with anything that sounds like interesting.
That is such a good point. I think that's really true too, because for Deep Throat, I said that Mulder, on the one hand, he's very dutiful and appreciative at the beginning, and he's, you know, like, there's a scene NEB, but he comes to his apartment, to Mulder's apartment, and Mulder's like, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for, it's almost like he's getting an award for the work that he's done on his behalf, you know, and he's just so, you know, effusively grateful to him. And Deep Throat's just kind of like, you know, just very like not wanting to emote with Mulder, which I understand, but it's just this expectation, like, this person has done so much for me. And then I think Scully has the reasoned perspective, like, you need to be skeptical of this person and what is he really about. And so then Mulder kind of flips to the other side of that. You know, it's like, you weren't perfect, and so now I'm going to be against you.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, it's just like emoting in the moment when his expectations aren't really, like, they don't ever center completely on reality. Yeah. Sometimes, like you said, for better, sometimes for worse.
Yeah, and
sorry, no, I was going to say, it's all or nothing with Mulder, isn't it? I mean, he's so single-minded and at times really selfish. You know, like you said, he's not appreciative of what other people have done for him, and sometimes he doesn't stop to think that. But when he does, but he's quite a bulldozer sometimes, is Mulder, and I think he sometimes doesn't really stop to take stock of what people he's used or affected.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting what you mentioned, Marlene, about that scene in EBE where he's emoting to Deep Throat, and Deep Throat looks deeply uncomfortable, partly because he's lying to him at the moment, but he also because it's probably not super comfortable. I mean, just a generalization, like, males sometimes struggle to emote with other males. So I think Deep Throat is not super comfortable in that moment, but it's again how Luke, you mentioned that Mulder opens up or really understands Skinner once Skinner opens up to him, and in one breath, I think Mulder was craving something tangible from Deep Throat in that moment. Something like, oh, you've been such a great son figure to me, and you've done a great job searching for the truth. Something like that. And
right. It was all worth it. Yeah. Just for your work, Mulder.
That would have been an amazing last line if Scully had dragged Mulder's body to him as he's dying, and Deep Throat manages to tell him how proud he is just as he dies. Might have ruined the scene, but...
right.
Yeah.
It's like scenes.
I mean, weirdly, Mulder does get that reaction from Deep Throat, but in that weird spiritual thing in Blessing Way, he kind of gets that, doesn't he? He gets that kind of thing, but not in real life.
That's true.
Oh, he gets it in Amor Fati too. I mean, that's also a dream, and they're both like what Mulder. Right. I mean, what I imagine is Mulder's almost his subconscious, like what he's yearning for them to have felt for him, which is kind of heartbreaking when you think about it. Like, you know, in Amor Fati, Deep Throat is, you know, calling him son. He's acting very paternal to him and just like very comforting to him. And it's like, it's really sad that this is kind of what Mulder hopes for. I mean, even CSM in that episode is paternal towards him in his dreams. And it's like what Mulder lost from his childhood, the childhood tragedy. And it's what he's constantly yearning for, whether it be CSM or, you know, someone, you know, like Deep Throat or Bill Patterson from Grotesque, or just anyone who he builds up any expectations in.
Yeah, it does seem to flip, doesn't it? Like the wanting the approval and being so affiliative to then having some sort of, you know, break with that person, I guess. But both of those examples that you gave, they're almost like a parade of father figures, both in Amor Fati and in The Blessing Way. Yeah. You know, it really is just kind of in his mind. And this is a tangent, but it reminds me of the hypnosis scene in The Field Where I Died, when he kind of, I guess, imagines Scully in other lifetimes.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
For him.
Yeah, I mean, I always noticed that in the superficial way of, oh, Scully's a guy in his past life regression. But that's really interesting if you think about it deeper, that Scully... Because Scully is not openly emotional either. Like, she's closed. I mean, she's the definition of closed off. And I wonder if just that gender dynamic swap there, and the fact, though, that she's so persistently, doggedly, you know, behind him in his quest, you know, and this, not to make this, like, warped or anything, but she almost, that is a good point, like, that she almost takes up, like, what his expectation of these father figures would have been for himself. You know, she's the voice of reason for him. She's the one who's constantly telling him, hey, be practical about this. Don't get too emotional about this, you know. Stop and think about this logically.
She keeps him honest, that, as she says.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm, definitely.
That's an interesting dynamic to consider.
I've never thought about that part of Mulder and Scully, which is crazy because they're like the center of the show.
There's another aspect with the whole father and son thing. And I think it carries through with William Mulder, Deep Throat, to a very small extent, the Smoking Man. But all those father figures and all those people have deep sins in their life. And it's almost as though they're using Mulder as a way of repenting for those sins and trying to get redemption through Mulder. And I like that aspect that Mulder is kind of being used by them to make themselves feel better about what they did in the past.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I think Mulder, as the show goes on, gets more and more jaded towards that. Granted, like, the father figures sort of drop, I guess there's less of them as the show moves on, but I think just knowing Deep Throat lied to him, that his father may not be his father, that CSM may be his father and has lied to him throughout his life, that, you know, I mean, in a bad episode, Colonel Belt was not the noble, heroic figure for him that he thought he was. Like, just, I think over the course of the show, and Bill Patterson, you know, got possessed by a demon and murdered people. But I think as the show goes on, he gets more jaded, and that might explain why he has fewer interactions with father figures. I mean, he might just not seek them out as much. I mean, I think it's just sort of the show forgets about them a little bit. Like, Senator Matheson is only in, like, one episode in the sixth season. But I just think Mulder as a character probably susses out his, I guess, this pattern, and just sort of, like, probably, I think as the show moves on, stops seeking it out so much. Yeah, I think his expectations lessen as the show goes on.
Mm-hmm. I could see that. I could see him being more jaded, and I think that that also coincides with the show kind of funneling the sort of father relationship to CSM, you know, which I don't know if that, like, focusing so strongly on that was a great thing or not for the show, but I do think that Mulder, you know, for whatever reason, wasn't maybe looking for that as much in these other people the way he was.
I wasn't too keen on the whole focusing on CM as the father. And I also wasn't really happy with how they dealt with Matheson either. Like, I really enjoyed his first two appearances as this kind of kindly man, and he's even alluded to in the pilot, isn't he? You know, I had connections in Congress, and you can kind of imagine Matheson being that person.
Yeah.
And I like their familiarity and closeness. And you've got a sense of history. And, you know, in Little Green Men, when you met him, you had a sense that these two have known each other for quite many years. And I really like that dynamic between them. But the way they went with him, and, you know, with SR-819, I wasn't personally happy with that storyline and what they did with him.
Yeah, the writers occasionally just go the route of, let's make him a bad guy for the shock value, which just undermines what, you know, some potential that could have been had there.
Or telling a story that didn't need to be told. Yeah. Like, there doesn't have to be a backstory or a side story. It could just be that, like, the nuance we get from Mulder speaking to him, you know. It's interesting, too. I just thought of this, but Senator Matheson sends for Mulder in Little Green Men almost like... I mean, not to stretch this too far, but it's almost like a parent calling the child. I mean, he sent a car for him.
Bring
whatever,
my son to me.
Still, he sent for him.
Correcting him about his Mozart or Bach. It's a very kind of, like, you know, Know your music, son.
And
right.
And in that scene, Mulder even says, "I know I've disappointed you." Yeah, you know,
it's mm-hmm.
it's much more prevalent than I realized before thinking about this last night. Like, just how much that sense of trying to aspire for their approval is a part of his, like, his core. So, I guess transitioning a little bit away from the father figures, what's interesting to me is when he's dealing with peers, he's much more like acerbic and just snarky, sarcastic, and very territorial. I guess the characters that came into my mind are, well, Krychek, which obviously he ends up being a huge villain, Spender, who becomes, you know, a minor villain, Doggett, and then characters like Tom Colton. When Mulder sniffs anyone out around his work, he gets super snarky, and he kind of comes off as a jerk to everyone, like even before they've shown their true colors. Like, I mean, if had Krychek been a good guy, had Spender been a good guy, mm-hmm. you know, their first interactions with him is, you know, Mulder ditches Krychek after lying to him and just heads off in the middle of Krychek's investigation, leaving him behind. It's like Mulder doesn't care at all what these people think, what his peers think about him at all. He just, you know, whereas he's seeking approval from father figures, when it comes to peers, he's like, I do this by myself. Or with Scully, but I do most of this by myself. And mm-hmm. Krychek being assigned with me, nah, not happening. Spender, yeah, that's not going to work with him. But I just think it's interesting that he's so just rigidly against them. Even Doggett, who's a noble character, it takes several episodes for Mulder to warm up to him in season 8.
I think the Krychek one is interesting because at the beginning, he ditched Krychek, but then once Krychek caught up to him and they had that whole, like, conversation about, like, oh, I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings, but which he says in a snarky way. But I think it's not as negative when Mulder thought that Krychek was just this young, kind of inexperienced agent, you know, like there was a little, like, I agree with you what you're saying, but I think there's just like a little hint of him kind of taking him under his wing, or like that Krychek seemed vulnerable in that moment.
There's a weird kind of symbiotic relationship with these two, and the fact they kind of need each other on a certain level. And, you know, Krychek always comes to Mulder if there is, you know, if there's a truth that needs to be exposed or something like that. Krychek likes to come to Mulder to kind of, you know, give him a bit of info. And, you know, the Red and Black are prime example when he bursts into his flat and he kisses his cheek and says, "Good luck to you, my friend," in Russian. I think there's a very underlying mutual respect between the two, even though Mulder's first reaction whenever he sees Krychek is to punch him in the face. But it's that kind of violent hello that I think was a running joke for all the X-Files when he meets Krychek. But I think there is a certain need between the two.
Yeah.
Mulder obviously hates Krychek because he murdered his father. But, like, I think as the show moves on, especially after that scene in The Red and the Black, I think Mulder at least realizes Krychek is not, you know, fully evil. Like, you know, he's not pure evil like some of the other characters in the show. Although, I guess even, like, you know, CSM has got shades of gray until he goes full-on evil in the last season. But one thing, Marlene, what you mentioned about, you know, when Krychek showed that vulnerability again, and then that's when Mulder sort of started taking him under the wing, that does play into exactly how he is with even his father figures. You know, it's, again, vulnerability, like, show that you're actually invested in what I'm invested in, and I will go to the ends of the world with you. It's basically how Mulder behaves. Because Spender, even if he wasn't CSM's son or, you know, doing some of CSM's bidding, Spender clearly was not invested in the work and disrespected the work, and so that relationship would never have worked at all. But had Krychek actually not been a villain, I do wonder, you know, they probably would have been good allies.
I could see Mulder working with, like, a younger, less experienced agent and helping him along more so than someone that was a direct peer.
Yeah, I think he'd like to work with someone who he can mold into who he wants and kind of feed him his beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he can mold into Mulder.
Yeah, but I think it's right. I think it's that. I think it's the, again, like, that emotional vulnerability too. It's not necessarily like when you were talking about Skinner reopening the X-Files. You look at it as like, oh, Skinner is doing this as a formality, or, you know, if he reopened them, why couldn't he prevent them from being closed and that sort of thing. But it's also, I don't think that Mulder has as much respect for like an executive decision of that sort as he does and for an emotional reaction.
That's the thing. I mean, the you know, Mulder, I guess he's not the traditional male archetype hero on a TV show. He is a very emotional character, and that's like what he needs from other people to connect with them. He is not like a rigidly like practical or logical man. He's constantly vulnerable. He's constantly got his heart on his sleeve, even when he's, you know, when he confronts Doggett after in I think it's three words, when he just shoves him in his office and down on the chair. It's a antagonistic moment, but then Mulder immediately launches into an emotional tirade about how Doggett is like hoarding in on his work. It's always driven by emotion. It's rarely based on rationality.
Yeah, I think Mulder's quite an emotionally compromised person anyway, isn't he? I mean, he's had some pretty horrible trauma in his life, and I think that certainly drives his reactions throughout the series and how I react to certain individuals, particularly with men. But kind of going back to both your points about him being an emotional man, I think that was quite a unique thing if you put it in the context of 90s television. You've got these quite emotional men, and they're having scenes together who, you know, they're opening their hearts, and I just think that was a real turning point in 90s television, really, in that respect.
Mulder cries a lot on the show, and I can't remember if earlier 90s shows had male characters crying a lot. I know they do now, but, you know, every one of them genuinely, you know, works for me. I think David Duchovny cries pretty well. He acts those scenes really well, even though some people have accused him of doing a smiley cry, which everyone ugly cries. But I think he, like, that open vulnerability just as a character, a male character itself, is just really interesting. And I think that's one of the things that drew me into the show when I was young and got into the show is just, I mean, it's why Mulder is my favorite character, is his raw vulnerability. Even if he is a selfish, narcissistic, like kind of an elitist, like punk ass at times, but he is my favorite character because just that raw, wounded animal Mulder, you know, it's kind of heartbreaking.
It comes across as very genuine too. I don't think it's I would not rate all of his crying performances like
that is like true
the same. I think there's some that are definitely superior to others, but I would say they're all about people or about something that's genuine and real. It's not like an issue or something that's, you know, removed. It's something that's like very visceral and sometimes about him, but it's more often about someone else.
And all the times he cries, he's either on his own or with Scully. He never cries in front of another man, which is an interesting point.
That is interesting.
Yeah. Oh, he did. Oh, yes, you're right.
His father, or Almo, maybe he held it back, but
that's the one where he has his back to him, right? Like he's in Endgame when he's telling him about
Samantha.
It's just the deep shame. Can't doesn't want to show his face to him. And that, you know, that strikes me though, the emotional vulnerability, the way he craves that from the other father figures in his life. It's probably a very, you know, stereotypical male role models that he's had who, you know, aren't emotionally available and stuff. So it's a very tough dynamic. I mean, just as, you know, as a male growing up myself personally, I'm more of an emotional guy than most guys that I know. And it's just, sometimes it's hard for them to understand it or try to open up. It's always a little bit challenging. So for Mulder, I feel like he's so different from these men who have mentored him or have raised him. And it's adding stress to his relationships.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, I had something on Doggett since we mentioned him. Doggett has that very strong, forthright personality, and he's not going to – I mean, he has – I wouldn't even call it passion. I mean, he's more dramatic, but he's kind of dramatic in the way that – a variant on the way that Scully is. Like, they're almost more comrades, whereas I think, like, with somebody like with Doggett that has this very strong and forthright personality, Mulder immediately almost seeks conflict with that type of person. And it could be kind of like – I was thinking about what you were saying, Chandru, that maybe he doesn't – he can't – you know, he's not going to have somebody that's going to respond to him with vulnerability, emotional vulnerability, you know. So his other option is almost like combat, it seems like sometimes.
I just think Mulder doesn't know how to handle that other than, like, if there's no emotional availability, he doesn't know how to handle it without just launching in, like you said, open combat, like almost taking the initiative and getting out ahead of it. Doggett is not an emotionally open guy. I don't remember him ever really opening up emotionally. Definitely not to Mulder. What I think earns Mulder's trust in Doggett is Mulder, after, over the course of several episodes, realizes that that steadfast nature of Doggett's, that, I mean, no pun intended, that dogged nature for Doggett is actually passion for doing the right thing. And in the end, what Mulder wants from everyone in his life, male or female, is for them to do the right thing. So I think that's where, that's why Doggett and he end up as, I think, did you mention comrades towards the end of season 8? I wish Duchovny had stayed for season 9 because I loved both Mulder's relationship with Doggett and with Reyes. Just the different, giving, you know, David Duchovny and Mulder a different, I guess, sort of characters to play against versus just, you know, the routine that he had with Scully at that point.
Yeah, particularly with Viennin, which is a very kind of action buddy cop partnership, isn't it, between Mulder and Doggett. And that's the kind of turning point, really, with their relationship where, you know, Mulder, you know, he's felt threatened that he's losing the X-Files and maybe even losing Scully as well. And he's very combative nature, but he slowly turns around and kind of gains a bit of respect for Doggett. And that phone call at the end with Kerr, she goes, it's yours now. It's your responsibility. And I like the fact that their relationship gets to that point rather than just being hostile through Mulder's exit.
And correct me if I'm misremembering, but it never feels like Doggett takes things too personally from Mulder. He seems to understand, like, why Mulder would think he's, like, horning on his work and not on his side. And Doggett doesn't seem to, Doggett's obviously annoyed and agitated with Mulder, but he never, Mulder launches the all-out war on John Doggett, and John Doggett just sort of is like, all right, you know, he lets him spin his wheels for a while, lets him burn out of all of his energy, and then eventually he's like, he'll figure out that I'm a good guy. And, you know, that's kind of exactly what happens over the course of however many episodes that was.
John sees it as a job, and Mulder sees it as his life. And I think that's the difference between the two.
And Mulder has to learn that just because Doggett sees it as a job doesn't mean that's a bad thing. It could still mean he's passionate about his job. It's not his quest. It's not his holy grail.
I think a big difference is what you said. Like, he doesn't take it personally. And not just that, I think he does not take things personally. And Mulder tends to take a lot of things maybe a little too personally. That's a very different.
And one thing, Mulder with peers, his male peers, it's very different than how he is with his female. And unfortunately, we don't have that many examples to contrast that against. But, you know, like Diana Fowley, his ex-lover. Mm-hmm. So it's already mixed up with, you know, other facets of the relationship, whereas a character comes in, like a male character roughly the same age, and Mulder senses a threat immediately. But a female character, it's like, okay, Diana Fowley, I have a history with her, but I trust her implicitly, even though Scully, my voice of reason, is pointing out all these really good points about her. Or Marita Covarrubias, I mean, I don't know how great of examples for contrast these are, because I don't think either character's betrayal of him really works all that great. But I just think Mulder is, so with Mr. X, Mulder is way more prone to just lash out viciously and get into contentious arguments. Whereas with Marita, it's almost like he can't fathom that the women in his life will betray him. Whereas the males, he preemptively tries to attack any perceived upcoming betrayal.
I just think he has more in common sometimes with the women characters. Yeah. And not just that, I mean, not so much like in those examples. I mean, even if you look at Back to Space.
Michelle Gennaro.
Is it Michelle? Yeah, I can't believe I thought of this one as my example. And I mean, she's not necessarily a peer, because in that episode, she's sort of being victimized and so forth. But in terms of her job and, you know, that type of thing, she would be on probably a somewhat equal par with Mulder. And there's the caretaking aspect of it, which I think in some ways Mulder has to have. Like, he's the vulnerability coming down to him from the sort of superiors, if you will, or like the father figures or authority figures. But then also, I don't think he doesn't make people into victims. I think he genuinely wants to help people not be victims, but I think he has that affinity for people that have been victimized, men and women. But I think of like her, of Michelle, as one of those people that he's just immediately more drawn to.
I'm trying to think of female examples. Unfortunately, I feel like the show didn't do enough, I guess, intergender relationships for either character.
Well, they think they're female law enforcement, they have, I mean, they're more male, I suppose, but the ones that are female, I would say that Mulder has, I don't know exactly what it is, but he just seems to have more an affinity for those people.
Yeah, and I mean, it probably has a lot to do with this.
Right. And it's not like, let me take care of you, never, little lady. I mean, it's not at all. It's like almost the opposite.
I don't think
of
it's
that,
ever
you know?
A conscious thing on Mulder's part, but I think it is. I think it is got to be subconsciously related to his sister. And I don't think he like you said. I don't think he sets out to make them victims. But I think I just personally see him as all his father figures. He learns over the course of the show, like, okay, a lot of them have betrayed me or done shady stuff. His mother, he never suspects of anything until demons. Mm-hmm. His scene with her. It's actually very similar to the one with Bill Mulder, where he can't make eye contact with her in front of Scully, I think, when he's actually lashing out to her. To me, that scene with his mother it's a different type of hurt that he has than what he has with the male figures in his life. It's like, with the male figures, he's hurt when with the betrayals. It's almost always laced with, I expected this. With his mother, I mean, granted, it's his mother, so it's going to be harsh, but it's like, I never in my life would have fathomed this being a thing. It does not register.
It's interesting, yeah. It's interesting what you said about Mulder's relationship with women, and I think it's particularly prevalent when he's talking to either suspects or people involved in the cases. Like, if you think about VJ from Aubrey, or the, I can't remember her name, but the lady in Zainun Zeet who's in jail because they thought... Yep. Yeah. But he's very tender and very kind of understanding with those women.
Yes. Yeah, I think he's like that with... I don't think that just comes down to females. I always feel like it comes down to... I think one of you had already said it. Basically, whether they are the victim... Like, what, you know, if they're the reason... If they're cause... You know, like, Robert Patrick Modell is a murderer and Mulder does not empathize with him. But the characters that are not entirely at fault. I mean, this is a bad example because I don't think Jerry Schnauss is... not entirely at fault for murdering all those women, but Mulder is a little bit more empathetic with him than he is with Robert Modell. You know, he's got that background in psychology, and Mulder just needs like a tiny bit of, you know, a little hook to grab his empathy, and then he'll be on your side, you know, even a tiny bit.
I always think of Max, mainly Max Fennig, mainly in Fallen Angel, and in other episodes as well, and Tempest Fugitive and Max, but and when the scene in the trailer when Max has a seizure and Mulder is holding him, that's a wonderful scene, and it's very compassionate, like kind of loving scene to have between two men. But Max was sort of a sensitive soul as well, so he would be easy for anyone.
That
to
is
have
my
empathy.
That's one of my favorite scenes from the first season. It's like a minute long almost of Mulder just comforting this man who's having a seizure, and it's one of the most moving moments of the season. I mean, it's part Duchovny's acting, it's Mark Snow's score in that moment, but and Scott Bellis is acting also. But it's just a great moment to highlight Mulder's empathy. I feel like it crystallizes who Mulder is behind, you know, the constant sarcastic jokes and some of his self-righteousness. You know, he is a man who wants to help others.
It's almost like, you know, his jerk behavior is his defensive unit, isn't it? It's him kind of putting the walls up, and you know, he just acts like a jerk and takes the piss out of other people. But when it's people like Max who he, you know, he kind of has a kindred spirit with, you know, an understanding and a compassion with, then he, you know, I think he acts more like the real Mulder rather than the walls up jerk Mulder.
Yeah. And then in Tempest Fugitive and Max, you know, Max isn't in the episode as much, and Mulder's reactions to Max's death are kind of underplayed, but I think they're beautiful also in that episode. Just their quiet moments. Like, I think there's a moment where he opens up the body bag. He doesn't say anything. It's just, he just takes a deep breath, puts his hand over his mouth. You almost get the sense that Mulder feels he failed him. And you get that sense again in Max when they're watching the video and you can see Mulder's reflection in the TV. And again, underplayed and not a subtly directed scene, but it just, you know what Mulder's feeling in that moment. He's like, I wish I could have done something for this guy. This guy almost needed me and I couldn't save him. It's another reason why I love this character of Mulder.
Well, he seems to have almost like an emotional reverence for Max beyond Max's station in life, you know? Like, Mulder has sort of elevated him, and I think that it was probably based, even on that first meeting, which is very goofy when they're in the motel room where he's trying to crawl out the window, but he was vulnerable. Max was kind of vulnerable with him at that time, too. So I think that sort of, you know, pulled Mulder in a genuine way, too, like, not in a betrayal way. I mean, it was regretful the way it worked, but it was a, you know, a relationship that had
I think it's why Mulder's relationship with Duane Barry is also really interesting, because... I mean, Dwayne Barry's history, it's just ripe for Mulder's empathy. And all of Dwayne Barry is Mulder empathizing with basically this ticking time bomb. And it's just, it's an amazing acting job. Like acting, like David Duchovny acting, not that Mulder's acting in that moment, but it's just great to see Mulder empathizing throughout an episode in such tense, like, circumstances. It is heartbreaking, again, like that, you know, Dwayne Barry ends up kidnapping Scully. Everything that happened in Dwayne Barry is still true, except Dwayne Barry is now the enemy to him, and Mulder feels betrayed, and like that his empathy had almost been manipulated. So the combination of Scully being kidnapped and just the roller coaster of emotions Mulder had to go through in terms of his relationship with Dwayne Barry, I think led to him, you know, starting to strangle him in that interrogation. I think it's just another good relationship to highlight between the two, or between Mulder and males. Characters that he has less empathy for, though, like characters that just don't give him anything, like, you know, basically suspects that he doesn't empathize with. He is so antagonistic, and he almost taunts them during episodes. Like, I'm thinking in general, Rob Roberts in Hungry. What's Bruce Campbell's character's name in Terms of Endearment? Yes, Wayne Weinsider.
Wayne Weinsider. <It's> like,
fantastic name.
I don't know.
Just taunts them mercilessly throughout the episode. Almost like he's like throughout the episode. Like, hey, I got you. Mm-hmm. I got you. You know, I'm going to catch you. It's really interesting. It's such a stark difference from all these other relationships we've talked about. Almost fun-loving Mulder when he's dealing with these characters that aren't weighed down by emotional baggage. It's like Mulder gets to free himself of his empathy and just like do his job really well, and he can't help himself and just taunts these characters.
And what's really interesting is when these characters taunt Mulder back. I mean, prime example is Robert Patrick Modell, who is in control of the situation for most of the time.
Yeah.
But that's a real kind of Sherlock Moriarty type, you know, archetypal relationship. You know, a real battle of the wits and the intellect. And yeah. I love that kind of relationship that he has with Modell. And it, to a certain extent, Faster, but I think that's more to do with Scully's journey. But to a certain extent, there is that kind of cat and mouse game of wits element to it, and I love that. And I think that's when Mulder's real intellect comes out as well.
Yeah, I guess when his foil is able to intellectually battle him back, he's still sardonic, but he drops kind of the arrogant vibe. So like Robert Patrick Modell, and then I think John Lee Roche, is that his name in Paper Hearts?
Yeah.
I can never remember the full name. But it's like these characters can match him intellectually and also are very dangerous. And
they don't have empathy. Like, that's their... Right. Sort of characteristic Mulder, in common, yeah.
When it's a character that can battle, like, sort of battle him back, and where it's, you know, the stakes are higher, Mulder drops the pompous act and is like, goes back into emotional vulnerability. His vulnerability around John Lee Roche. This is a killer who's basically telling you, hey, I might have killed your sister, and Mulder's still such an empath around him, just so emotionally open to him, and he takes full advantage of it. And Modell, I think, to a lesser extent, that's more just like a battle of wills. But I mean, Modell still manipulates Mulder. He sort of plays him into going into this one-on-one showdown at the end.
And he knows about Scully's background as well, because he's playing on that too to bring out the emotional.
And the thing with Modell is also that stand-up between him isn't just a battle of intellect. It's also a kind of battle of machismo as well, isn't it? It's these two men kind of battling it out. And that all comes down to Modell's need to be important. You know, the little man needs to be important and remembered for something. And in a way, Mulder's like that as well, though. And I think that's why these two have this kind of standoff with each other.
Mulder gets into those macho machismo. I can't pronounce that word. I won't even try. But he gets into those moments where he's like, almost, I need to meet the male stereotype and be this like strong, tough guy. I can never tell if it's written like that or if it's just incidental, but I always feel like it comes off like Mulder putting on an act in some of those moments. Like with Modell, I think it's more of a raw, I do need to defeat this guy, and there's a little bit of that. There's, you know, in Tunguska with Mulder, when Mulder's got Krycek and he's just whipping on him the entire episode, a part of me at one point was like, this is kind of stupid. But now I look at it like, it's not stupid. It's Mulder thinks this is what a tough guy should be doing. I don't want to say that. I don't think he's like consciously doing it, but it's almost like, well, maybe he is consciously, but it's like Mulder's trying. This is hard for me to discern. It's like, where is Mulder, like, sort of trying to meet the expectation of what a tough guy does in this moment? Because when he's beating up on Krycek the first couple of times, it's like, okay, he has some history with him. But the last couple of times when he's like, stupid ass haircut, I'm like, okay, Mulder, you're not fooling anyone. But I feel like he goes into these modes where with Morris Fletcher in Dreamland 2, when they both are in the bathroom, and then he's like, oh, you're the man who's trying to steal my life. Does that include all the ass kickings too? I'm like, Mulder, how many ass kickings have you actually not been on the receiving end of? It always feels like Mulder puts on like a sort of a tough guy veneer sometimes.
Oh, I thought that's what he was talking about, is like getting the ass kickings.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I always took it as like, you want my life. Does that include all the ass kickings?
Oh, I did not think that. I thought it was, that would be awesome. If that is, that's awesome. Because that, I have always thought that's Mulder putting on an air, but if it's the other way around.
Oh, interesting. Okay. No, I thought it was like him saying, like, I might get my ass kicked.
If it's that, then I'm like, wow, that's really self-deprecating of Mulder. I like that.
Well, usually by Skinner, isn't it? I mean, if he ate, you know, one throw of a punch at Skinner and Skinner's got him in a headlock, it's like, you're done now, mate. That's it. That's it. You're done. So, yeah, I suppose he has kind of admitted that he just get his ass kicked.
I got to watch Dreamland 2. It's not my favorite two-parter, but I want to watch it again now.
One thing I thought of that doesn't, I'm not sure exactly how it fits, but Mulder with the sheriff in Chimera, Sheriff Phil Adderley, I think it's more mature than what we have been discussing. And it's also like a little bit later in the show, so that makes sense. But it's the scene when they're at the breakfast table and Mulder is, it's like the taunting that you were talking about that he does sometimes, except it's done in, it's not straightforward at first, but Mulder is not, I don't feel like it's machismo or anything like that, but he's pretty much telling him, like, I know you're having an affair. And he tells him the thing about, like, you have a piece of evidence in your possession that I'd like
he's
back. And he's just very, he's confident. And he's like, I only woke up one time when he went out at whatever time it was, you know, that sort of thing. So he's kind of playing him, but I don't think that it's Mulder trying to one-up him. I think he's just letting him know, like, I know you're doing something immoral, you know, and that you've been lying and so forth. Yeah. And I always love that part of it, because the sheriff is sort of trying to approach him in a different, I mean, I hate to say like male way, because I don't think it's like
male
way, but you know, like that kind of, hey, we're guys, don't you understand this? And Mulder's like, no, I don't. Yeah. And you have some evidence that I want. And just like flat out tells him. And you can see the guy getting more and more nervous, but Mulder's not doing anything physical. He's just kind of calm sitting there, you know. And I thought that was a more mature version of him dealing with some of these people that come at him in a kind of, you know,
that's a great example, and I didn't think of that. We don't see it too often in the show, but that sheriff approached him like Mulder might be a bro, and Mulder's the least bro-like guy ever. Like,
he's a no bro.
So like an interaction like that, like that's playing into Mulder's hand, trying to play up like, hey, we're guys here. That'll never work with Mulder. Mulder does not like people acting immorally, and that just won't work with him.
That's really interesting, Marley, when you said about him kind of questioning the sheriff about an affair, because he's realized this. But if you look back to Aubrey, where Lieutenant Tillman is having an affair with the policewoman, he's completely oblivious to it. And it's actually Scully who picks up on when the whole thing. So that's an interesting kind of contrast.
Right. Oh, I like that.
I wonder if maybe because Mulder's constantly calling Scully in Chimera, maybe he's filling her in on all the details. And she's like, you should check with the sheriff. It sounds like he's having an affair. And so maybe it's all Mulder getting all the ideas from Scully.
That's like behind the scenes. That would be pretty funny. That's another, we need to have like writing of these behind the scenes.
If we ever do that, I'm in. But so staying on the theme of law enforcement, obviously the X-Files, the cases are usually supernatural in nature, and someone, you know, a layman is not going to generally be open to these extreme possibilities with no pretense. Mulder has like this attitude towards these characters. What we mentioned earlier about his interactions with Piers, he sort of jumps, he has these knee-jerk reactions. Like, so the ones I'm thinking of are, there's the cop in Blood. Once Mulder gets sprayed by the chemical, like, and he's talking with Scully, and that cop's in the room, and Mulder starts explaining his, you know, his theory that's a little bit out there, and the cop walks out of the room, and Mulder assumes this guy is not willing to believe, and he makes a a smart-ass joke to Scully. But the guy was actually going out to negotiate with, you know, I forget what the other guy was, but this cop was going out to negotiate with the guy who was doing the spraying to figure out a course of action. But Mulder jumped to the reaction of, this guy is not buying anything, so let's make a joke at his expense. Sort of similar with Mike Millar in Tempest Fugit and Max. That starts off antagonistic because Mulder is like, this is alien abductions, and this guy's doing his job, but he's doing it wrong because he's not looking at alien abductions, which no one's going to look at alien abductions right away. Again, with like the expectations he places on people, it's a little different than with his father figures. It's justified in the fact that Mulder's usually right in the show. To me, it comes off as very elitist. Well, maybe not elitist. It comes off as like, I know better than you, and I'm going to make it known that I know better than you. And I love it when these characters, like, sort of, when Mulder accepts them. Mike Millar is the perfect example. He realizes Mike Millar, you know, is straight-laced and he's going to be focused on real world, you know, the most likely causes. But Mike Millar ends up open to what Mulder's, you know, his hypothesis. And there's a growing respect in that relationship over the course of that two-parter that I think is really good.
Yeah, Mike Millar is one of my favorite kind of law enforcement type relationship. They're both after the same thing. They're both after the truth. And I think the writers were very clever because it's quite a serious issue that they're dealing with, which is a, you know, a plane crash with lots of deaths. So you kind of understand Mike's point of view when Mulder's spouting off this alien abduction theory, and you kind of sympathize with Mike going, well, yeah, because this is a really serious kind of incident. Why would I even consider that, you know, that kind of ridiculous story? But, you know, as you said, Trendy, that this growing respect that they get through the two-part, which I really like, and this kind of growing dynamic between them, I really appreciate. And I think Mike Miller's one of the most least hostile of the law enforcement people that we get as well. He's quite a kind-hearted, laid-back man as well, which I like, instead of just, you know, the oh, you're full of crap kind of characters.
Yeah.
I really like Mike Millar as well. I think that at the beginning, it seems like he's going to be almost a trope.
Yeah.
You know, that character that's kind of hard and, you know, thinks Mulder is being ridiculous and is just like based on the facts and doesn't want to hear what Mulder has to say and so forth. And he's not giving Mulder any validation. I think that's kind of what puts Mulder off, is that he's not validating his ideas. But he's more open, of course, you know, as we see going on, like you're talking about. And he's not a one-note character, which is what it looks like he's going to be set up to be. And I think that that's the thing that I like about him. But yeah, with regard to Mulder, he's like, that's all I can think of is like the validation. He's not giving him that. Like, he's, again, like making executive decisions, but Mulder needs that little like bit of personal affinity that somebody believes him or even believes in the possibility of what he's saying.
Like a lot of people, but Mulder specifically, just he mentions it in Squeeze. When Scully says, you're acting very territorial, and he says, or right before that, he says, like, I deal with so much outright hostility. He's sort of like primed to expect hostility at every turn. And I feel like it takes work for some of these characters that he expects hostility, like law enforcement. He just expects it. It takes work, and he needs to see actual compelling evidence from their behavior to be able to be like, okay, this guy's good. This guy's my kind of dude.
He says something like, the chance to mess with their heads outweighs the millstone of humiliation. Something like that. That's like a little on the defensive side, you know, like he's just gonna jump in there almost before they can reject him, you know.
Tom Colton, I feel like he's like the prime example of an antagonistic just guy, sort of colleague of Mulder's. Like, season one is sort of riddled with these one off characters. He's probably the most prevalent one, but, you know, there's a bunch of episodes where, like, I think in Lazarus and Squeeze again, where other agents just randomly make fun of Mulder. That sort of gets lost as the show goes on. I think season four, I think it's like three seasons. There's like a three-season gap between when he gets called Spooky. Field Where I Died, he gets called Spooky again by one of the FBI, part of the briefing where they say, our man Spooky did this, and it's... I feel like that's Morgan and Wong sort of bringing that back, because I do wish some of the like seasons 2, 3, 4, 5, like the classic seasons, had more of that, where Mulder's being sort of disrespected by his peers, because I think that gets lost after season one for a while.
You were talking about, Marlene, about Mulder wanting validation. I think that issue is quite heavily prevalent in his relationship with Bill Patterson. It's a mentor who is you know, who is actually quite hostile towards Mulder, but he's doing it because of his respect for him. So he's not giving him the easy road. But he knows of Mulder's abilities, but doesn't want to let on that he knows it. And I like this real tense relationship mm-hmm. that they have. And Mulder, I think Mulder wants to get his approval, but at the same time doesn't want it at the same time, if you know what I mean. It's a conflicting thing he's got in his head. Like he says, I hate to disappoint you by disappointing you. Yeah, by not disappointing you, yeah.
Oh, by not disappointing you. Wasn't that it? Yes, that's a great line.
And Bill Patterson is, you know, he comes from the Walter Skinner like school of emotional availability. He seems like he would be the last person to be like emotionally open with Mulder. And I feel kind of bad that, you know, Agent Nemhauser in that episode, he tells Scully about how Patterson tells Mulder stories, you know, over you get a beer in him. It's like, oh man, if Mulder heard that, like, I wonder what his reaction would be. Almost be like, oh, I lost his chance of, he almost loses his purpose of proving Patterson wrong and that, like, I can do this. Or is it more like, ah, yes, I got his respect. I love him. Or like, I wonder what his reaction to hearing that would have been.
I wonder what it would have been like if Nemhauser had been more of a character. I mean, he kind of was, but he was more just of a, maybe not a foil, but he was just sort of like, you know.
It's a red herring.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But if there had been more like of a character built for him to interact with Mulder, I wonder how that would have gone. That would have been interesting because he seems like he would be more empathetic character.
I was thinking of that also along the lines of Mulder would see him as like, oh, he and Patterson are working together. So is this guy taking my place? Like, I wonder if it would have been combative or, but yeah, Nemhauser isn't really given much to do. Although he does have a really grotesque death. Again, no pun intended. So there's one character that I thought of that I couldn't quite figure out where he fits, but that's a well-manicured man. Based on age, he's like a father figure, but every time he shows up, he gives Mulder nuggets of information, and Mulder sort of laps it up, and he gets, you know, he's the same like sort of antagonistic way he is with a lot of these characters, but I feel like there's a slightly different dynamic at play here, and it's, I think the fact that Mulder meets the well-manicured man, he knows that he's part of the conspiracy right from the beginning. There's no loss of trust there. He hasn't put the well-manicured man up on a pedestal like he has with like Deep Throat or with his father. So he's able to take all the news that he learns from the well-manicured man as just, you know, he's pissed at him for like being a selfish conspirator against the American people, against, you know, against the people in general. I feel like Mulder is less antagonistic towards him than towards some of the characters that he feels like a betrayal towards or betrayal from. With Deep Throat, there's a lot of vitriol when he feels like Deep Throat, you know, lied to him. Or with Skinner, when he feels like Skinner, like in Zero Sum, when he thinks Skinner has betrayed him, there's so much pent up hurt and anger. With the well-manicured man, he almost just treats him as, this guy's a bad guy, but I know he's a bad guy. He hasn't done anything directly to me, and I'll just take his information and have some heated arguments. It struck me as just like a different sort of dynamic.
Yeah, I've always seen the well-manicured man as a secret super fan of Mulder and Scully. And, you know, I think he's one of the only syndicates that has a sense of morality because he does start questioning their choices and the project and what they've done, which is why he's reaching out to both of them. I always kind of think that maybe the well-manicured man and Deep Throat went for a pint with each other down the pub or something, and those two kind of share the same psychology and mentality and you know, they're both starting to regret certain things, and I think that's the reason why they reach out to Mulder.
Yeah, they're having a pint, and in walks Bill Patterson, Agent Nemhauser, and that's when they have a beer and start trading Mulder stories.
We have another scene we have to write.
Yeah, but I what you were saying, Luke, though, that makes perfect sense, though. Like, the fact that maybe it's not a fact, but like the idea that he's a super fan of Mulder, and Mulder probably senses that, and that's why he's able to be less acerbic towards him, because he senses that, yeah, the well-manicured man has been up to shady stuff, but so has my father, and they're and Deep Throat, and this, you know, cigarette smoking man is full on antagonistic in several scenes, but the cigarette smoking man has to tell Mulder, hey, I have shades of gray. If Mulder just looks at him, it's just black and white with him. But with well-manicured man, I think he comes from a point of this guy, you know, he has shades of gray. It's like, it's neither too evil, or he doesn't come from, you know, he's not my mentor. So I think that helps him in terms of just being on a more even ground with him.
I sort of think, too, that the well-manicured man isn't, he doesn't have this emotional hook out for Mulder the way that cigarette-smoking man does. Yeah. So his communication to either Mulder or Scully is just like very like logical, very fact-based. And he'll say things like, my God, once in a while. Yeah. It's an expression that's more based on information. It's not like his deep emotion about something or about, you know, we need to relate as family or anything like that. Whereas with, you know, Scully and Anami and a couple other times, and then Mulder, you know, basically all the time, he's putting that personal twist in there as well. And so Mulder has that sort of, you know, some... on some level, like the personal affiliation with the cigarette smoking man that he doesn't have with well-manicured man. And I think it's interesting too, kind of the way they communicate, because I think the scenes with Scully and the well-manicured man are in some ways more compelling because you have these people that sort of communicate through logic that are having a heated discussion, but it's more just on information is the way it comes across to me. Whereas like cigarette smoking man and Mulder, it's like there's an emotional tone to it. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think Mulder's earlier interactions with Cigarette Smoking Man are much more effective back before we know he's his father, because it's I feel like those just work better. Once, you know, once we get into like season 7 and, you know, the teaser in Amorfati when he flat out says, "I am your father."
You make it, but, right.
Yeah, I feel like their relationship takes on so much melodrama that that just doesn't work anymore. It does, you know, the character work is still probably working there, but I feel like I mentally tune out a bit at that point. Because it just doesn't feel earned anymore. It just feels like cliche of he's my father and let's have classic father-son dynamics here. It just doesn't work as well. And I think from Mulder's standpoint, the fact that well-manicured man doesn't have a hook out for him, I think Mulder subconsciously probably appreciates the fact that this guy is not using me. He probably thinks he's using me, but not in the same way. He's not using me. Mm-hmm. For emotional gain, or he's not like playing on my emotions like all these other men in my life or all these other people in my life. It's
The well manicured man more fact-based. Uses them, you know, a means to an end, whereas I think the cigarette smoking man wants Mulder to be him. He wants to bring Mulder into the circle and be his his successor in a way. And then my favorite last scene or good scene between Mulder and the cigarette smoking man is that scene in Red and Black, which is the mirror image of the scene in One Breath where he invades his flat, and you get that kind of where he's sat on the chair and he's got a gun to his head. I think that was the last effective scene between them. In Red and Black,
Do you mean in two?
Yeah,
I think you mean in season 6, right?
Is it Red and Black? It is Red and Black, okay, where he goes to Dinah Fowley's flat and then the smoking man comes in.
I think...
Was it One Shot? Do apologize.
I'm getting my seasons mixed up.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, it's okay.
There's so much overlap. I was just trying to think.
But yeah, so now that scene in season 6 is my last favourite scene between those two before it gets a little bit too melodramatic.
Before the melodrama. That's CSM... actually opening up, I guess. That's his version of opening up, right? That's him articulating and justifying his reasons. And when I first watched it, I remember thinking, why is Mulder like falling into this trap of just believing him? But it plays so well into it. As soon as someone opens up emotionally to Mulder, he trusts them like implicitly. And like CSM is telling him, there's no point, it's all over. And Mulder just loses his drive, like, and Scully's the one who has to drive the rest of that episode to get them moving again. It's just interesting that Mulder just, it's like you play on his emotions and he's out for the count. Watching it from the standpoint of, oh, we watch One Son and we're like, why is Mulder being so stupid here? But it's really like, if you think about his character, it's so sad just how defeated he is in that moment.
Yeah, that's true. I do think it's it though, like the emotional motivation.
So there's one character who definitely does not give Mulder anything emotional, at least emotionally like supportive, and that's X. X is one of my favorite characters, purest and like one of the most purely antagonistic relationships for Mulder. X's mission statement right up front is like, "I'm shady. I don't want to be here. I barely want to help you, but my loyalty towards Deep Throat is why I'm here. You don't need to trust me. Half the time, I'm gonna maybe." Possibly kill you. I might save you from a blowing up train car, but Like, it's weird because that's one of my favorite relationships with Mulder, but it's also like the least nuanced because it's just pure macho screaming at each other and arguing with each other. And no, you're wrong. I'm wrong. Like, just there's no Mulder doesn't have that emotional hook with him. I don't know. It's just interesting. Because I'm rambling. I can't figure it out.
No. I want to hear what you have to say about this, because I just thought about when you're talking. Do you think, though, that Mulder is trying to make that relationship more nuanced than it is?
Absolutely, I think he is. Like, I think that's what Mulder's...
that's what I'm getting.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. I didn't think of it until you mentioned it, but as you said that, I'm like, of course that's what Mulder wants. Mulder wants to be pointing, like, have a gun pointed at his face and be, like, screaming at him and, like, not just to say, I used to be you, but to say, hey, I also had, like, all these personal losses in my life and all this stuff, and
right.
that's just not what X is going to do, because X wants to get the hell out of there as soon as possible. I think it's... fresh bones, he comes to him, you know, when they meet out on the highway, and he says, I assumed our last meeting would have been our last. And there's almost a sense of almost like relief that they're having this meeting again. Mm-hmm. Like Mulder was happy that that was not their last meeting. And it's like, maybe you'll give me something here, like emotionally.
I think you can,
right.
You can encapsulate the X and Mulder relationship down to one line, which is, you're a damn schoolboy, Mulder. And I think that literally is their relationship in a nutshell.
It's true.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
That is
like,
perfect.
He wants that information, but he wants to know, like, why are you providing this information? Or, like, what is this about? And so forth. Whereas I think that Scully, in the dealings that we saw that she had with X, those few that she had, it's like, she gets the information, it's like, great, thank you, this is what I wanted.
Oh, yeah.
But Mulder wants, like, something
Scully,
more, you know?
Scully's direct. Scully's like, you know about this train car, what those experiments, right. Give me the information, and pulls a gun on him in 731. Mulder, though, he needs more. And it's X's MO is, you know, I'm in danger, I'm going to be sweating throughout my scenes, and I am going to get, you know, just get out of here as soon as possible. And what, again, Mulder, it's only after X dies that Mulder can think back on all the things X did for him, because X is constantly putting himself in danger for Mulder. You know, another classic scene that was not written, but had Mulder woken up in X's arms as he's carrying him away from the exploding train car. I wonder how Mulder would have reacted. Would he have swooned in his arms and been like, oh my God, my hero? Or would it have, like, I just wonder, seriously, I just wonder, would there have just been like this newfound respect and admiration for X? Or would it have just... would it have stayed sort of the same? When he dies in Herrenvogt, it's after that month hiatus went before he meets with Marita, he's had time to think, and when he refers to him, he calls him his friend.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
That is interesting. Actually, like a couple times when you would talk about one that was coming up, I was wondering if you're going to say this one.
Ah, yes.
Bill Scully. So Scully's brother.
Ah, oh, I forgot. How did I forget about him?
I mean, it's not, a relationship that we've seen much of, but those scenes that we have, I think, really tie into a lot of the things that we've been discussing.
Yeah.
I think no other character has really shown their intense dislike for Mulder than Bill Scully. He blames Mulder for all of Scully's decisions, and I think that's the crux of that relationship, isn't it? I think.
And it's like full dislike, and in Mulder's mind, it's full justifiable dislike. Like, he doesn't... Yeah. Mulder doesn't try to argue his way out of, you know, in my opinion, Bill Scully is his sister's, his family's going through a traumatic experience, so it's natural to want to blame someone. And I think it's partially Mulder's fault, but it's more nuanced than that. But from Mulder's point of view, he's like, bring it on, I deserve this. When he meets Bill Scully, he's at a point where he kind of is like, just give it to me, I deserve it. I'm responsible, it's all because I've been just looking for little green men. It's interesting because Bill Scully, again, there's only like two episodes with him, right? I think it's Emily and this one, and he doesn't really interact with them in Emily, right? I really wish there had been more interactions with them, because that is like a pairing where one of the characters has justifiable animosity towards Mulder. It's just an interesting dynamic.
Can you imagine like a cop buddy team up with Fox Mulder and Bill Scully on an Ori?
Yeah.
But, yeah. That would be something else.
Complete opposites.
Yeah. But it goes, I think, because the line in Emily, the only line I remember between them is when they pass each other, when yep. Mulder's going in to testify on Scully's behalf and Scully's family is walking out and her brother says, they're ready for you,
yep.
or something like that.
His, I forget the, is it Pat mm-hmm. Skipper's the actor? There's so much like negative connotation in how he's saying it. They're ready for you. He's like, basically like, this guy again, like this yeah. guy's going to screw everything up. Another moment that's going to ruin my sister's life.
Yeah.
And it's just so much resentment towards Mulder.
It's almost like he's saying in that, like, they're ready for you now, like, you ridiculous creature or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because even when we were talking about Deep Throat and Mulder's father and so forth, and how Mulder has this, you know, he's, I don't know, going from like being appreciative and overly, you know, solicitous of, I guess, affection, into being like defiant and skeptical and not really having that middle ground. I feel like Bill Scully is somebody like, Why are his emotions all over the place? So like, would just be very founded in reality. This is how it is, to an extreme degree, such that he doesn't see the emotional support that Scully obviously needs from Mulder, you know, and he's just like, this guy's ridiculous. So he clearly dislikes him for what he's doing, but I think it's probably also that he can't handle Mulder's yeah. emotional, I don't want to say volatility, but to a degree volatility, or just his variance between those two extremes, maybe.
And I think if Mulder had met Bill Scully at an earlier time, Mulder would have been much nastier towards him, because Bill Scully is like kind of like the closed-minded person that Mulder hates to deal with, like the people who are just not open at all to anything other than their rigid view. Mm-hmm. Does he actually say something like that to him? I'm trying to remember it. I feel like
he does, doesn't he, in Redux 2? About letting a family tragedy unfold.
Yes, yes. Because I don't sit idly by while watching the family tragedy unfold. That's like the one time where Mulder sort of defends himself in that episode. It's, you know, he's accepting the blame, but he's not, when it comes time to like, you know, let's try the chip out rather than rely on our faith or rely on science. And Bill Scully is like adamantly against that. That's when Mulder's button is pushed in that situation. It's like, your sister is dying and you're not willing to try anything for her. That's unacceptable to Mulder.
Yeah, I think Mulder would have been nastier earlier. I think we would have got, you know, Colton level mockery if they'd met earlier in life, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been great. That would have been so inappropriate if, you know, he's like, what? Like, Bill Scully's like, what, little green men?
Gray.
And then Mulder's like,
gray.
Gray. Oh, God. Reticulans.
An entirely different episode altogether.
It's so totally actually, out of place gray. In Redux 2. Yeah.
Starts talking about reticulants in the middle of the hospital scene.
And their liver extract and how they like liver and onions. Yeah. And it's like...
Oh, no. That would have been something else.
Yeah, I think it would have ruined the episode, but I would have loved it.
Yeah, absolutely. The emotional tone might have been slightly off, but never mind.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was... It's wonderful to think about that now and very amusing, but that was probably the correct writing voice at the time to have Mulder let that go.
I have one last character that I was going to bring up that sort of plays into Mulder's expectations, and that's Clyde Bruckman. Mm. So it's just one episode, but Mulder meets Clyde Bruckman and immediately puts all these weighty emotional expectations on him. Like, you have this gift, got to use it for like exactly what I think would be the perfect purpose to help humanity. And like, as he interacts with Clyde Bruckman, his opinion of Clyde Bruckman deteriorates because Clyde Bruckman is not, he's weighed down by the tragic circumstances of his life, of being able to see his own death and not being able to escape all that death and despair around him in any moment. And Mulder just can't understand. Mulder built up his own expectations of Clyde Bruckman in the moment that he met him. Just because Clyde Bruckman didn't meet that expectation that Mulder constructed, Mulder's sort of attitude towards him deteriorates. And that's when Scully sort of swaps with him in terms of just their level of empathy for Clyde Bruckman. This is interesting because I never noticed that facet of his relationship with Clyde Bruckman and how it fits in with how he is towards other men in his life.
I love that. I think it's a great example. I actually had Clyde Bruckman on my list, but more so because it goes along with what you're saying. So I said that Mulder, he's fascinated by his ability, but he's sort of dismissive of him as a person. But you're right, that dismissal is like after Clyde Bruckman isn't completely on board with Mulder's enthusiasm for how he's using, you know,
yeah,
his particular gift or what he thinks of his gift.
Yep.
Whereas Scully, I think, you know, I mean, she's skeptical of the claims, but then she empathizes a bit more with his plight in life, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
And Clyde Brightman doesn't have, like, I mean, he tells the story of his own death in a very matter-of-fact way, or how he sees his death. Like, he's not going to be, you know, he's not going to give that emotion to it, you know, right off the bat, like Mulder is looking for, maybe.
And Clyde Brightman's also really flippant and sarcastic, which Mulder is also, but I don't think Mulder's used to dealing with that, because Clyde Brockman opens up several times in the episode, but I think Mulder dismisses him, A, because he doesn't know how to deal with his being mm-hmm. flippant, and B, just the fact that he's not using this power for this power for good as Mulder would think in his mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got one last example, which kind of segues quite nicely because they're both psychics, which is Harold Piller. I find him really interesting because, one, him and Mulder are so similar because they've been looking for a lost loved one all their life. You know, he lost his son. So that brings them together immediately. Also, I think if Mulder had met Harold much earlier, I don't think he would have been as open to go full force into their path.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, the episode is hyper elevated anyway. It's a very emotional two-parter, whether you like it or not, because I know this two-parter kind of divides the X-Files community. Yeah. But, I mean, personally, I like it on certain levels. But what I really like about the character of Harold is that Harold represents what Mulder could have been if Mulder had not accepted the truth. And I really like that dynamic.
Yes.
Between.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned that he would have, had he met Harold earlier, it wouldn't have worked out as well. And that's, I feel like, earlier, Mulder would have bristled at what he would have perceived as Harold sort of giving up and believing in, I guess in Mulder's mind, like fairy tales, because Mulder and spirituality don't work well together. Yeah. But by the time closure comes about, he's ready for closure. He's ready to be released. And I think that allows him to relate to Harold Piller more than, say, like a season two Mulder.
Yeah, I think he might have been overly hopeful and then overly dismissive. Once we got a little bit more into Harold's story, I think that's a good point. Because Harold's one of those people that's very marginalized. You know, again, like, take Scully really, like, laying into Mulder and telling him, this is the situation and you need to pay attention to this. But Mulder doesn't lose his empathy at that point either, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Harold Piller sort of straddles a bunch of these categories. He's kind of similar to Max Fennig in terms of what you were saying. Like, he's been, I forget how you worded it, Marlene, but just how he's been dismissed or has been sort of, I guess ostracized,
yeah,
right?
Marginalized,
I can't remember exactly.
Is what I said about Harold.
Yeah, that's the word what you used. Yep. That does call to Mulder, you know, that calls to Mulder's empathy immediately. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting.
I was wondering what you guys thought of the Lone Gunman, like the Boys Club type vibe, doesn't it?
Mm.
I guess you brought it up, Luke. You want
to... Well, no, I just think, you know, it's I like it because... Tonally, it's nice in episodes because you look forward to, you know, when you see their names up on the credits, you know you're going to get your nice little scene in the office, and that's always a nice thing to look forward to. Again, I'm one of those people who enjoyed earlier season Lone Gunman rather than later season Lone Gunman because I like the setting in the office, and I think that it's a really good environment, and I preferred that type of relationship. I like the fact that it's almost a boys club brethren type environment with them, and that first episode in EBE, I like the way Mulder indulges the Lone Gunman to kind of show off to Scully a little bit, aren't they? You know, really. And I like the way that Mulder's really enjoying it as well. I think he's great.
No, I do like their relationship. But, I mean, the Lone Gunman are great because, you know, heavy episodes, they tend to lighten the mood. But and like you guys, I like the earlier seasons. But I like it because, you know, these are kindred spirits for Mulder. So Mulder's obviously going to relate to them. But also... I feel like it's one of the few situations where Mulder can feel like, hey, I'm the cool guy in this group.
Yes.
Like he almost feels like he's at the top of the hierarchy in whenever he's hanging out with them.
Mm-hmm.
Like he can make lots of jokes at their expense because he doesn't usually directly make fun of people. And I mean, I think it comes out of from a place of love with these guys. Cause I think he genuinely loves the Lone Gunman, but he's always like making fun of them. And I just think it's a fun, like the Boys Club thing. It's funny and it's endearing
And also they can be quite mocking to him. You know, Langley says, that's why we like you, Mulder, because your ideas are like, weirder than ours. It's a kind of to and fro thing with him, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
I enjoy their earlier years a lot more than the later ones for several reasons. You know, but there are a couple of things, though, that I think come out in the later seasons. Because I think overall, it's a very like sort of trusting and friendly relationship, an environment for Mulder to be in. But I think later, the one benefit I see is that you see some differences among them in how they relate to Mulder. And I think that's kind of interesting. Because I think there's a little more reserve, particularly with Byers, toward Mulder. Whereas I think like with Scully, she seems to have more of an affinity for Byers. And not necessarily like not to the other two, but I think... And it's not even mean it in like in favoritism or any negative way, but there seemed to be a little bit more of like a sense of individual relationships later on that I think is interesting.
Yeah. I think what I was saying earlier about Mulder almost like picking on them, it's almost like that's almost exclusively with Frohnke. He almost has like he has like the big brother, little brother relationship with him. Whereas with the other two, he's got, you know, good relationships with them, but it's less, I guess, outwardly shown. It's more like he respects them for what they, what, you know, what their purpose is in life and like just for what they do. But with Frohnke, you know, he's hugging him after coming back from the dead in season 8, the constant jokes about porn with Frohnke.
Yeah.
I wonder if other than Scully, if Frohnke's his best friend.
Maybe.
Like if someone asked Mulder, hey, who's your best friend? It's it's definitely
I think it's that shared love of porn. It has to be, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't think any of them come across, I mean, it's kind of hard to say because they are minor characters. I don't think any of the lone gunmen come off as judgmental. And I think Mulder probably senses that, like he's getting something from them that's very genuine. But I think that, I mean, for probably obvious reasons, Frohnke would be like the least judgmental person perhaps on the entire series. So I think they could see that being something that would appeal to Mulder.
That's a good point about the lack of judgment, because that's the exact opposite of how he feels with like Tom Colton. So he like all of his jokes with the lone gunman are, you know, based on fondness and mutual respect, because he can be himself. He can be open with them. If he says what he says, they're not going to mock him. And then he doesn't have to just like go put up his defensive walls and be the, you know, a sort of condescending, the condescending guy that he is with Colton or something. He's just more like jokey with these guys. Yeah,
when Mulder
undergoes
hypnosis and the, you know, the psychiatrist goes, now take yourself to a safe place. You know he's going to the office. In his mind, he's going to the office. That's his safe place.
Yeah, yeah. He's they're like, we want to go back and talk about your sister's disappearance. He's like, where are you? I'm like, I'm at the lone gunman's office. Like, well, that's really odd. But
that's great. I can see that. Yeah. I think that's a good one. Unless you have another one, that's a good one to end on. I feel like there's a lot more we could talk about with that and imagine scenes, but I like the lone gunman being the end of it.
I actually have like five more, but I'm so hungry.
Oh, I do too. Like, I don't think I don't have more written down, but I could go on and on. I know we need to have this be like a two-parter or something. Yeah.
We need a cliffhanger then. Well, that's tough on a podcast.
I know. It seems like Mulder, like we've talked about this a little bit, it's Mulder having a stronger connection and being more affiliative with men that are like have that sensitivity or that vulnerability, whether it's somebody that's, you know, above him in stature or somebody that needs his help and so forth. And I feel like the vulnerability could be like a situation in life. I mean, even somebody less intelligent than him. And you'd think Mulder might be a bit of a snob about that. But if someone is, you know, give a few examples when a person that's just can't think quite the way he is, but they're, you know, needing help. And I feel like he's sort of sensitive to that too. So
Detective Boggs, I think his name from Irresistible.
Yeah.
Like he's
that's
just
a good one.
Just, you know, the cop who he's open to extreme possibilities. He's not, I mean, I don't mean this as an insult. He doesn't seem to be Mulder's intellectual equal, but
he's just a hard worker.
Mulder
basic.
Is like, yeah. Mulder's gung ho to help him. And I wonder if,
Box, I think. B-O-C-K-S.
Box. Yeah, that's what I think it is.
Okay, Box. If Box was less, you know, if he wasn't just like a full-on believer, if he was just more of an open-minded, like, you know, hey, can you help me with this investigation? And I'm open to anything, whether Mulder would have had the same, you know, similar to Mike Millar, grown to respect him, or if he would have respected him from the beginning, or if he would have been sort of antagonistic towards him from the
Box
start.
Was a great subversion of your typical law enforcement hostile character, wasn't he? Which is a nice little throw in.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
We should have included him earlier, but I'm glad we got to him. That's a good example. Well, in the interest of hunger, we'll go through our listener replies. It's always that. It always ends like somebody, when I have to eat, usually. So from Twitter, Sarah Blair says that the interactions of Mulder and Sheriff Hint and Quagmire will forever be my favorite. Chris Ellis is perfect in that role. That's
a fun one,
I think.
That is a good one. I was not thinking like the more comedic ones. Yeah, so I missed it. I didn't even think of that one.
Okay, so a few of the Facebook ones are long. I'll try to just get the gist of it. Kathy Glensky said, it talks about Mulder's relationship with Deep Throat as a father figure. So we've talked about it a little bit, but she says that basically that when they first meet, Mulder reacts like an adolescent and he's not willing to accept because I said so as an answer. And then he's, you know, in need of his father figure, showing an interest in him. She says, I like that we see Mulder learn that Deep Throat isn't perfect, can't be trusted completely, but he still maintains his respect and affection for the man. And it's a more mature relationship.
I just wanted to mention, so if Deep Throat hadn't died, do you think Mulder would have been like, because Mulder has like almost like this posthumous reverence for the people who've died, like similar to X, how he's become a friend after the fact, or Deep Throat, because Deep Throat like lied to him in EB, and then in the Erlenmeyer flask, they're contentious still. Mulder doesn't fully trust him. I wonder if he hadn't died, whether it would have been just like respect after the fact, or whether it would have maybe deteriorated or had to be mended.
Yeah, that's a good question. Mid-season 2, they might be going out for a meal together or something, possibly.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. Because like, would he have retired and then X would have taken over, and so Deep Throat would have been a little bit off the hook in terms of being the informant? Like, I can just be a little more laid back with Mulder now. Like, they could have. You know? Yeah.
Deep Throat starts bringing X to his clandestine meetings. He's like, oh, here's my
other
intern.
Guy. Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Exactly. And then when they're finished with the meeting, X would be like, all right, well, Deep Throat is waiting for you at the pub or wherever for your dinner and beer. Continue this later. Yeah, that's a good question. Like, does Mulder memorialize people and improve them after they've died? He seems to. So
I think that's pretty prevalent in the Blessing Way, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even in the revival in this, you know, they still talk about it.
Yeah.
So Cara Dwin Foley says that talks about Mulder's father issues and that how fascinating she finds them with Deep Throat, Skinner, Senator Matheson, Bill Patterson, and CSM, all the ones that we mentioned. She said there's a strain of withholding in every one of these otherwise disparate relationships. So it like, goes back to the conversation we had, just kind of replicating the relationship with his father. And she talks about relationships with younger men that are not father figures and says that Spender and Krycek have almost a protective posture to them that's different from the relationships that he gets into with law enforcement. You get the impression that Mulder is almost starved for equitable male relationships. And that the gunmen are the closest pretty much, but they seem to be they kind of hero worship him a little bit. She talks about Mulder enjoying Krycek's company at the beginning in Sleepless, even if it's in enmity, just having someone that's a possible person for him to work with, like not a worthy adversary. But just a part of him says that it's frustrated and he tried to befriend him.
Hey, even in Ascension, he's in an emotional like tornado of an episode, but he's genuinely trusting Krycek too much. Even little things like just calling him Alex.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know, Doggett and Scully don't even call each other by first name until that's inexplicably starts in season 9's premiere. But it's interesting.
See, Alicia Walker-Share talks about the Mulder-Skinner relationship having a slow build of respect that was eventually friendship that developed over the seasons. And that although Mulder and Scully questions his allegiance, Mulder's faith in him didn't waver. And she wouldn't exactly call Skinner a father figure to Mulder. He provided the respect, trust, and sometimes the reproof that was needed in Mulder's life. She says, I think Doggett could have been this type of person in Mulder's life as well had that relationship been able to develop further. I don't see them, again, like I don't see them necessarily as fathers, but I do think that there's that sort of emotional component that's very similar. And then she says, I was also intrigued by Mulder's relationship with his father as we saw it in the series and his desire to understand his father's motives and to make him proud, as well as the heartbreak when his father was killed, makes me believe that Bill Mulder was a better man deep down than some people basically thought that he was. I think that's like part of that, the wanting to understand his father's motives and always wondering like why or wanting something more emotionally kind of tie in with what we were talking about with some of these characters that he relates to as well.
Yeah.
Some of these people, they have a lot. I'm trying to not like read every single thing, but she had a lot to say that was very good. Ronald Wilson says the early seasons had a particular focus on Mulder's relationship to law enforcement figures, whether local or fellow FBI agents, usually unattached to the conspiracy. So he was talking about the ambitious agents that are trying to use his talents and steal credit, like in Squeeze and Ghost in the Machine, which we didn't mention, Ghost in the Machine. So I think it was Jerry. Was it Jerry?
I had him written down, but I thought he was poorly written, true. So I didn't want to talk about him.
Yeah. A little bit of a stock character. But I think it's a good example in here. Yeah. And then regular agents who quickly learn to take him seriously, like in Lazarus, and then various one-off scientists that he consulted before Chuck Burks showed up. Chuck Burks was another one. Like, he's another character that is sort of on the margins just because of, like, he's chosen to be, basically, that Mulder has an affinity for. And he's kind of a pleasant guy, too, so I guess I could see them.
Well, I forgot whose comment you mentioned, but someone said the Lone Gunman have, like, hero worship for him.
No character.
I feel like Mulder has... I think that's a great point by her, because I think Mulder has, like, this sort of this sect of fans, like the Lone Gunman, Chuck Burke, and Max. like basically Mulder groupies.
So he's talking about, like, law enforcement. Sometimes the sheer types are grumpy with his fancy FBI techniques and so forth. So he's talking about just the kind of the standard sheriffs. And then he says, like, the sheriffs sometimes were the ones that the whodunit basically are part of the problem, which we talked a little bit about.
Yeah, there was certainly an archetypal type of law enforcement in a lot of the episodes, wasn't there? You know, these cardboard cutout characters that were just there to greet them.
Yeah. And that was, I think that was fun earlier on. It's enjoyable to see and to kind of build Mulder's character. But, it's, you know, I'm glad we moved on from that as we went along. Do you guys have any parting thoughts?
I don't think so.
We've gotten a lot in.
No.
Well, go ahead then, and we'll talk about where our listeners can find you online.
I have a podcast called Pointless Rewind. A couple of buddies of mine, we talk about movies that we either love or have watched from the past, and we just sort of, you know, we go through and review them, make fun of them, do kind of what we did here, where we make up alternate scenes that could have happened. But so you can check out Pointless Rewind on Google Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and pretty much anywhere. And I also have a website, same name, Pointless Rewind, pointlessrewind.com. I write a lot about the X-Files, though I have not written in a while, because having a newborn makes it hard to write. So that is an eternal challenge. So, you can find me there.
Oh, great. Thank you, Jonjun.
You can find me personally on Twitter at Luke_Winch. I also host a podcast on the We Made This network called Observing the Pattern, which talks about the television series Fringe. You can find that on Spotify and iTunes. We're on Twitter at the OTP Podcast. I also co-host a Star Trek podcast with Kurt North, who is also part of the XCast team. And you can find that also on Spotify. And we're on Twitter at John Luke Poddard. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I love that.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
That's great. And I am Marlene Stimmy on Facebook, where I'm primarily in the our XCast basement group talking about the X-Files. Thank you guys so much for being part of this roundtable. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. And until next time, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Frame to Frame.
I mean, 2 years after he starred in this, Keanu Reeves became an action star with Point Break. It was only 2 years after this film.
Yeah, but Point Break is extremely camp.
Oh, yeah.
It's extremely overblown, extremely over the top. So Point Break is basically a homoerotic movie about surfers mixed in with a heist movie. So, you know, when you... I can see the lineage between them.
Yeah, so you're saying so there is a connection in tone between that and the sort of exaggerated style of Bill and Ted. Is that what you're kind of saying?
Like, that's what I was getting at, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you said it in better words.
Well, there are words on it. I didn't use bodacious, so I didn't get away with it. But...
Cerebral Jukebox.
I always like to draw from just as many different influences as possible, you know, just like... And that's just my taste, you know, I just like, you know, and I'm sure that's true of everybody really, but yeah, you know, like, so one minute I'll be listening to a opera aria, and the next I'll be listening to a Timmy Mallet or something. You know? I don't really like Timmy Mallet, but
I was going to say, have you got any sort of dark pop secrets, but you may have just given yourself away then.
Life's milestones.
I wanted to be a rapper called Razor.
Nice.
Yeah, my tongue was sharp like a razor, you see. Clever, right?
Can I call you Razor?
Yeah, I mean, if you want. I've been called much worse. Obviously, I spelt it incorrectly because rappers don't like to spell things right. So it was R-A-Y-Z-A because...
Nice.
Y because my tongue's sharp like a razor.
I think that spelling as well almost emphasizes the
Midlands pronunciation. Razor.
Razor? Yeah, oh God, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, I couldn't even escape it in my alter ego.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The XCast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the XCast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the XCast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the XCast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.